Yes, sir.
Awesome. All right. Hey, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to speak. Really appreciate it. It's my distinct pleasure to be speaking here. It's a very kind introduction for me. I'm just trying to figure out if I can potentially see the audience, but if not, that's fine. I hope you guys can see me and see my screen. Okay, I'm going to sort of get started. Okay, I think I can see at least what my screen is showing there.
Yes,
in terms of camera.
Yes, sir, we're able to see your presentation as well as you, sir.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. All right. So as I was introduced, I'm a professor at MIT, where I've been teaching since 2004. I primarily teach statistics, machine learning, or now everything we call AI. Over years, I have had distinct honor and pleasure of being a founding director of Statistics and Data Science Center, which is the academic unit for statistics and data science here at MIT. I believe that sort of over years as academia as well as industry, we have made tremendous progress in AI. What needs to be done is to bring this AI skills to the people and for the people and bring them by the people. And what that means really at the highest level is two important activities. One is to help educate broadly what it means to use AI. And two is enable individuals to provide tools that can help them sort of put those learnings in practice. Okay. So just to give you a simple example, I have a 7.5-year-old daughter, and you know, she doesn't know yet long form division. Okay. However, she knows what the concept of division means. So what that means is that, you know, she's got 27 cookies and she's got 9 friends visiting her, and she wants to decide how many cookies should she give to everyone. Well, she knows that she has to do division. Division of 27 divided by 9 is that she doesn't know how to do it herself, but then she would go and use her one of those modern electronic devices and do 27 divided by 9, and then she would get the answer. The point is that she knows how to think about division, and then she knows how to use a tool to do the division so that then she can actually sort of put that into practice. In a similar sense, what I strongly believe is that we are at the place where A, we need to enable education of AI so that everybody understands what it can and what it cannot do. There's a lot of myth around what it can do, but really it's at the end of the day, it's a science, and science can do only so much. We need to understand that. And second is, once we understand that, to put it into practice, we need tools. And that's a type of tools that have been built as part of Ikigai Labs that I founded 4 years ago out of my research at MIT. So really what I want to broadly tell you is why I'm really excited about bringing AI in society, in operations, and how do I think about it? Now, as we think about all of these things, it makes sense to start from a little bit of history. So if you think about history of AI, at the highest level, the term was coined in 1960s, and with a really idea that the goal is to mimic human behavior, but in an intelligent manner. Now, the term was officially coined in a paper that was written by one of my former colleague, Marvin Minsky, and his collaborators. And as my senior colleagues often joke, that maybe one of the best contributions that Marvin Minsky made to science is to introduce the term artificial intelligence. And maybe there's a bit of truth there. But besides the point, as AI has evolved, really the goal of AI has become to do really well using machines, but what humans can do. Okay, so for example, we can drive cars, machines should be able to drive a self-driving car, right? We can play games, machines should be able to play games really well, such as AlphaGo Zero coming out of DeepMind. You know, humans can provide customer support, machines should be able to provide customer support like chatbots. Okay, but AI is a lot more than just those things. Okay, as Minsky in his paper in 1960s wrote, in which they introduced term AI, well, he's hoping that machines will be capable to do within 20 years what any, well, they call it man, but I would call it any man or woman can do. But I'm still waiting for those 20 years, and I'm sure you too. Bottom line is, yes, there are sort of lots of ambitions, but AI has done only so much, and really we need to understand what it has done and what it can do. From the disciplines perspective, if we think about AI, really there are two parts. One is, as I would call it, the mind and the muscle. It's like mind is like learning from data, which also goes under machine learning, statistics. Muscle is like actuation mechanics, very much part of robotics and things like that. Traditionally for system design, especially AI system design, people use things like rules, decision trees, and all sorts. Over time, it has become a lot more sophisticated. Now, I think that the defining challenge of AI in our times is how do we bring AI and data, along with, of course, computation, together to do automation within an organization? Okay. So what do I really mean by that? Well, at the highest level, any organizations such as the one that you all extremely fine individuals represent, the end of the day, organization is defined by you, the people. I mean, a good organization needs two things. One is a terrific mission, but more importantly, people who can make it a success. And what that means is that if you want to bring automation in organization, we need to enable people to do automation, use AI and data for the people so that organizations are successful. Refining that a little bit, at the end of the day, as we discussed, creative organizations are enabled by individuals. If you think of any organization is driven by the mission, and the mission, well, in the for-profit or business is its financial instrument, but more generally, every organization is a mission, it's a success matrix. So really you want it to be a full instrument. Organization becomes success and achieve that by investing resources into it. So really at the end of the day, the goal would be to bring automation for decisions that humans make for the organization while remaining in the loop, with the aim of improving the return on investment. And again, returns are resources, and investment is however we measure the performance of organization. And again, going back to for-profit organization, that would be simply measured in terms of financial outcomes. So we want to do all of these things using AI and data. So in short, the way I think about one of the defining challenge of AI right now is how do we build these self-driving organizations, where organizations are, of course, driven by individuals, so you've got to keep them in the loop so that sort of return on investment for the organization is improved. Okay. Double-clicking a little bit more from the organization's perspective, at the highest level, organization has two sides. One which is kind of quote unquote front office, another is back office. Again, depending on what the organization may be, at the end of the day, the front office is what sort of interacts with outside world. Traditional businesses will be something like marketing, sales, customer support, and whatnot. Back office is what sort of keeps the organization running. And again, it's of some form of supply chain, some form of financial aspect, human resources, and many other such things. Okay. And these two together build the operations within organization. And typically these operations are run by the skills of individuals, their experiences. These are all always collaborative efforts. They're not individual team sports. They're team sports rather than individual sports. It's about individuals' instinct. And most importantly, it's about the passion. So it's a passionate individuals who are skilled, experienced, and have amazing instincts through a collaborative effort make organizations successful. Let me give you sort of a little bit of a run through how over time organizations have evolved in terms of using data and AI. And I'm going to do this with a very, very simple example of operations in retail. Operations in retail or operations in supply chain are broadly applicable and representative of the type of things we do across all sorts of organizations. And I'm sure some aspects of this as in a very similar form show up. And if they don't, please try to think of similar operational questions that come up in your organization. Would love to maybe when the time permits through question and answer, would love to receive your comments, your thoughts on these aspects. But with that, let me sort of take a simple example. And let's imagine that, bring it down a little bit. Let's think of a store where you're simply selling shoes, okay? And all you're doing is you're selling two types of shoes, red shoes and blue shoes, okay? And really the goal for you at this stage is to achieve best return on investment. And what would that mean? Well, you're running a store. In your store, you're selling shoes. The investment that you have is the amount of money that you have invested in keeping inventory on those shoes in your store. The returns is how much revenue you are making by selling those shoes. Okay, so let's suppose you have kept 100 rupee worth of shoes in your store every day, and every day you're selling 2 rupee worth of shoes. Let's say you're making profit of 2 rupee worth of shoes. That means 2% return you're getting per day, which means annually your return is 2 times 365 or so. That's amazing. On the other hand, on average, you are keeping 100 rupees worth of shoes on your store and you're selling, making profit of 2 rupees at the end of a year. That's 2% return. Maybe you should take that money out, stop your shoes, shoe store, and invest money into some reasonable, even savings account. Okay. So really, at the end of the day, you want to understand what is the return on your investment. Towards that, if you were operating this store in 1960s and 70s, what you would be doing is you are the store manager, you are the store operator, you're sitting on the store, people are coming in, you're looking at the shelves, you're understanding what's selling, what's not selling. And based on that, based on your instinct, you're deciding how much new shoes to order, when to order. And generally these kind of things, at least then, were done through paper ledgers, you know. You have this book, like classical accounting book, on left-hand side, entries of coming in, right-hand side, entries of going out, and then you tally those things. And that's how you keep track of things, okay? Very manual, very laborious, very error-prone, and at times incomplete because you forgot to write certain things, okay? And that was the status in 60s, right? Then world changed a little and computers came. One of the best thing computers did is instead of writing these things in piece of paper, now those things got digitized. Because things got digitized, it was a lot easier for us to keep track of all sorts of information. Okay, it was effectively, it became a one place where all the information was available. Now, a little bit more, computers were connected by network, and that was nice because now if you have store in Mumbai and Bangalore and Baroda, the information from all three stores are in one place. So through your headquarters sitting in Mumbai, now you can make a decision that what sorts of things are there in different stores and how much is coming in and how much is going out. And once you had a data in one place, suddenly realize, well, now you can start using data. You can start using data, which means you can keep track of information as well as understand what are the trends, what have been the profit margins last year, how quickly you are selling things that are coming into your platform, and so on. And that has been extremely useful. as one starts thinking about these things, I say, well, look, last season, I sold 10 shoes per day. So this season also, I'm going to sell 10 shoes per day. Okay, and that's what we called business intelligence. But things became sort of a little bit more interesting. I said, well, actually, it's not about the same thing. Last season was summer and people were not shopping that much. And now Diwali is coming. So maybe people are going to start buying more. So maybe now let's start forecasting the patterns and trends in the data itself so that we can do forecast a little better. And that's where interesting machine learning and all of that started coming in. But as this was happening, something more and more things happened. Okay, and in particular now, we've got a world which is everything sold electronically on multiple channels. You get things in actual stores, but you get things shipped online and you get all of those things. Okay? Effectively, your data is there. Data is there in many electronic systems, but it's all over. It's not just to one source of truth. Information about one thing is sitting in one place, information about other thing is sitting in another place, and there is no easy way to bring all of them in one place together. And when this happens, then again, we are back to the same situation as we were in 1960s. 1960s, we were paper. Now we have multiple data sources. And so effectively, we are back to looking at things into spreadsheets. It's like you get data from one place in spreadsheets, another place in spreadsheet, and try to somehow figure things out together. So we're back to the future effectively. And if you don't have data in one place, which means you can't do analyzing trends or profit and all of that, you can't do that. So really, it's a kind of a broken system. And as one tries to think about fixing this, and all organizations, and organizations not just in retail, organization in financial system, organization, any organization that has any form of operational data, they are suffering with effectively the same problem. Too many data sources, no common source of the truth. And if one starts thinking about getting all of this in one place, and if you, as in somebody doing operations using data, you want to make decisions using data, eventually, of course, with the interest of getting best return on investment, then you have to sort of struggle a lot. You have to go through a multiple stage of process to get to the end answer. And again, that's also a ton of tools, ton of skills, ton of time. Okay. So let's just sort of walk through what it would look like hypothetically. Okay. So first and foremost, again, going back to that context of the shoe store, let's say every day I need to decide how much inventory or how many more shoes to order so that my businesses continues to run. Again, some days I order, some days I don't. But at the end of the day, every day my operational question is this. And again, I'm using this question as a way to explain this generic phenomena. Okay, so first is finding out what is the ground truth. That is, how many shoes do I really have? That is, how many shoes do I have in Mumbai store, in a Baroda store, in a Bangalore store, on online warehouses and many other places. I just need to know, okay? And what that means is that I have to connect to different systems. My data is lying in many, many different data sources of all sorts. From there, I need to connect to those data sources, build some kind of a pipes or download things like that. Bring it in one place first, then stitch them together, prepare them so that I can get a common source of truth. And this is lots of tools, lots of people, lots of time, lots of money, but only then you will be able to get a source of truth. Let's assume that you did get a source of truth. What else? Well, next you will decide how much action you, what action to take. Going back to inventory, you will decide how much inventory to order. Let's suppose that for whatever reason, you have come up with this rule that anytime you see that in your store, number of shoes that are available are less than 10 days worth of demand, then you want to order 30 days worth of demand shoes, okay? So again, every day you look at your shelf and say, you know what, if number of shoes that are there are less than 10 days of demand of shoes, that means that in 10 days, I'm going to run out of these shoes. So I should order now because I know roughly 6 to 7 days it takes to for the shipment to arrive. For days. So I should order. Now, question is that how many days worth of demand that I should order? And I don't want to order every week. So maybe 30 days worth of demand. I don't want to order a year worth of demand because that's too much investment of money. I mean, ordering 30 days worth. Now, to answer this simple question, I need to know what is the demand in next 10 days and what is the demand in next 30 days. I need to forecast things. Okay, this needs machine learning. This needs advanced analytics. Maybe this also needs some kind of visualization tool so that I can understand whether my forecasts are meaningful or not. Interact with those things. Again, this requires a team of data analysts, data scientists, all of them working together, and a bunch of additional tools. Okay, here are just a few examples. Once that happens, and now I've made the decision, that's great. But every month or so, I want to sort of figure out whether strategically, you know, this is my rule that I have, that is, every day I ask myself a question. Do I have 10 days or more worth of inventory or not? If not, order 30 days worth of shoes. Are those right numbers? Should it be 10 and 30? Should it be 11 and 31? Should it be 11 and 29? How do I make that decision? Well, one way to think about it is that if I increase from 10 to 11, that means that I'm ordering things a little bit more proactively, which means that likely that I'm not going to run out of stock too often, but it's also likely that I might order a lot more. If I order 30 days worth, or maybe from 30 days I go to 29, I'm going to order less, which means that I might order sort of a little less, but then that might also mean I might be ordering a lot more frequently. So that means that depending on what choices you make over time, you do different level of investments. And over time, you make different level of revenues. And so what you really want to know, among all possible these scenarios, which scenario leads to what sorts of revenues and what sorts of investments? Putting it other way for any organization for that matter, you want to go through various what-if scenarios where you want to understand for each scenario, what would be the investment of resources and what would be the returns that you care about. And in a very simplified case, there are some point solutions, but really what if scenario is in the modern AI language, it's like reinforcement learning. And there are no tools available out there. And suppose you figured all of these things out and you want to do automation of all of these things, there are point bots that are available, but none of them help you do all of these things together. Okay. So in short, current ecosystem is totally broken because it requires a zoo of tools, large teams that need to work together on one problem, very, very hard, and it's just error prone. Okay. So what needs to be done really is to solve these problems, that is figuring out ground truth, whether multiple sources, schemas don't match, think data is dirty. Really, we need to sort of solve that problem first, and that's where we need AI. Is how do we bring AI to do data preparation? Second, data is constantly changing. Trends are constantly changing. Nothing is stationary. Data is typically very sparse. So you're really trying to make prediction problems with very limited information. So that again needs sort of advancement of high-dimensional statistics and machine learning. And then finally, to do scenario analysis, one is juggling with two things. One is, on the other hand, got multiple objectives playing a role. There are too many scenarios, and each of these scenarios need to be interpretable so that human decision maker can use these outcomes of that to actually put them into practice. Okay. And this is where my group has been over past decade has been working towards addressing these questions. And we've got sort of three nuggets that we've developed. One is what I would call DeepMatch, what it tries to do is that it utilizes AI to do data prep for disparate data sources together. As a DeepCast, which is about doing predictions at scale with extremely limited data. And then finally, DeepRL, which allows you to build interpretable reinforcement learning solutions for human-in-the-loop decision-making with large number of scenarios analyzed at scale. Okay, and put all of these things together, hopefully that'll help us do solve all of these problems. And you want to enable all of these things in one place, okay? So really, you want to have one place where so all of these things come together. Now, what I would like to do is maybe over the next minutes, walk you through a few examples of each of these things, just to give you a little bit more color of what I mean by each one of them. And then sort of talk a little bit about how does one think about this process end to end. I'm roughly halfway through, maybe a little bit more halfway through. Maybe let me sort of pause here for a second just to do the time check as well as see if there are any questions or comments that anybody has. All right, so if there is no question or comment, maybe I'll continue.
So you may proceed, sir. We will have the Q&A at the end of the talk.
Okay, sounds great. Okay, so let's sort of consider a situation, right, where we have connected different data sources. And this is just a simple example that's sort of animating. So you've got connected different data sources. In one source, you got names like this, which is, let's call it Jones Angela, in one place. And then in the second place, let's suppose she's just, I'm going to pause. So it's like one place, you got a name like Jones Angela, Blake Williams, Smith John, and all that. In the other place, you got a little bit different things, like your Jones A, which looks like this one, and Williams Blake, maybe it's like this because maybe we made a little bit of error there. And Dan Brown here, which is Daniel Brown, and so on. So there's a simple error, and this is a simple example, but more generally, it could be very messed up situation where there's no easy way to match two data sources. But maybe there is information within the data itself so that machine can pick it up and do the matching. Okay. So this kind of, and again, this is a very simple example, but hopefully it explains what a deep match means. That is, you got two sources of truth. In one, you got information which is, in both of them, there are rows that you can match, but there's no obvious way to match them. But maybe machine can pick up the pattern and match those things together and consolidate them. And that's how sort of create the source of truth. And this is what I would call a deep match, okay? And this is a, sort of the first type of sort of technology that we have developed. Highest level, the technical term that enables this is what's called graphical model, okay? So what does a graphical model look like? If you think of data as spreadsheets and names of the columns, and let's say, for example, one spreadsheet looks like this, where there is a name of a column is channel and purchase order. Another spreadsheet has name of the column supplier and order number. Okay. Then these two things can be viewed as two entities on the left. These two things can be seen as the two entities on the right. And then there is a various data points on the left, various data points on the right. From there, you try to learn the relationship between the entities across these data sources in an automated manner. And then that allows you to first learn the relationship, saying that, well, looks like purchase order is similar to order number. And then across rows, you say, well, this row, cherry blue, is like Excel cherry, or things like that. Okay. And that's how sort of you sort of first learn the structural relationship and then learn relationship between each pair of records, And to enable that is what sort of we call deep match, and that sort of enables doing this kind of data prep in an AI-driven manner at scale. Okay, this came out of one of my former students' thesis, Vinayak Ramesh. This is just a patent. This is enables at scale, and that's sort of what enables this kind of deep match functionality. Okay. Next thing I want to talk about is very briefly, but through a simple example, example of DeepCast, which enables accurate forecasting with very limited data when things are constantly changing. Okay. So for example, let's imagine that sort of there's some kind of time series. Okay, so it's again going back to retail example. It's a time series. This green time series is the real data. This blue time series is kind of a one step ahead version of it. And this is the true out of sample forecast. That's what is going to happen in the future. And there are various traditional time series methods that are very popular, such as what's called ARIMA, Box Jenkins, Holt-Wilter, and all that. And here is how on this data set, for example, what these traditional methods would do. One thing you might notice is that there's a lot of variability here and it continues, but then these methods simply predict average behavior and they throw out the variability. And to capture variability, you need to capture more structure within the data. If the variability is changing constantly, it's very hard. And that's what sort of these traditional methods don't have able to do. But this DeepCast actually picks that up. And the way it picks it up is by modeling uncertainty carefully, as well as learning from things beyond just one single thing. So the simple way to think about that is that, you know, let's say I'm running again a coffee shop, and at a coffee shop I'm selling a coffee and chai and samosas. Okay, now the sale of coffee and a samosa and a sale of chai and samosa are correlated in some form. So if I try to sort of bring information about selling of chai, selling of samosa and coffee together, maybe they can help each other and hence do better forecasting for each one of them. And that's primarily what we try to do here. There's a nice article that came out in MIT Press recently about this, as well as there's a open source in case sort of you want to sort of play with this kind of algorithms is available through this URL at MIT. Okay, so that's DeepCast. Okay, and here is how DeepCast might look like. Now, going back to that example of retail, if you have a good forecasting model that can help you understand how do you operationalize things. But at the end of the day, that's one thing in terms of sort of putting things operationalizing. Is you know that sort of what your demand would be for 10 days worth of shoes and what your demand would be for 30 days worth of shoes accurately. And hence it will help you make better implementation of the decision rule that you decided. But then the question is that which of these decision rule is better? The 10 days and 30 days or 9 days and 29 days or 9 days and 31 days? That requires you to do all sorts of scenario analysis. And what here we are doing is just showing you a plot of different possibility of Pareto boundaries of different scenarios. That is, one scenario might lead to an outcome like this, saying that this much of opportunity you're missing at this much of investment, or maybe you invest a lot more and maybe you are sort of losing a lot less opportunity. So those are the options. And question is that do you want to invest more or do you want to invest less? Okay, and which one of these operational points make more sense. Okay. And again, sort of, at the end of the day, you have to simulate large number of scenarios and that would make that feasible. There's a nice article that some of my colleagues wrote on this, and it's more of a light reading. So while I'm going to go to sleep at the end of the day, you guys will sort of continue this meeting. And when you go to sleep, if you can't fall asleep, you might sort of enjoy reading this as your bedtime reading. So bringing all of these three things together, this deep mesh, deep cast, and deep RL, what that does in one place is it enables going from this end-to-end process with the ease of spreadsheet or what I would call no-code platform. And it is done at the scale of cloud. And this is what we offer here at through the tool that we've developed at Ikigai Labs. And again, to do all of these things, now you don't need to use any of these platforms, but it's in one place, and that enables all of those processes. Okay. To commercialize this, my former student Vinayak and myself, we started the company Ikigai Labs. We're supported by the tech of MIT, as well as funded by many, including founders of Zoom and Databricks and all the other places. We can you hear me okay? I hope you can still hear me.
I can see you and I hear you, sir.
Sorry, I think I lost connection for a second. In either case, these are some of the organizations who use our tool within the organization to scale their operations and as well as sort of bring data-driven AI more broadly across teams. And with that, if you wanted to try, just try this this QR code, or just send a note, or go to the website and you can just try it out yourself. It's an easy to use self-serve tool. And do give us a feedback. So I think with that, let me stop sharing my screen. I hope I've stopped sharing it. And would love to sort of have a conversation with you and maybe answer some of the questions.
A very good morning to one and all present here in both online and on-site mode. I am Commander Bharat Jaiswar, Officer in Charge, Center of Excellence for AI and Big Data in Indian Navy, and will be the moderator for the talk. At the very outset, let me thank Dr. Devarish Shah for your talk, and personally thank you for being there at the near the midnight and Boston time and being with here with us. I would also like to speak, apprise the speaker that two professors from your alma mater, IIT Bombay, are here at on site at INS Valsura Jamnagar, Professor Kulkarni and Professor Hanawal with us, who are also present in this August gathering. So you have covered very interesting topics, which relates to deep mesh, deep cast, and deep DL, deep RL, and they do have a lot of interesting applications. Pertaining to defense as well, but before I have some questions of myself as well, but I would like to ask the audience if they have any questions, and the online audience can ask their questions on the MS Teams. Yes, sir. We have a question from Captain Srikant.
Sure. Morning, sir. I am Captain Srikant. Really great work, sir, with respect to deep match, because the sort of thing which was in the Navy, we have different verticals, which is gathering data at different point of, and we have already have a lot of data which is historical. Mm-hmm. And to take it forward, this deep match is what something which will certainly help, because connecting different databases which is storing in different data format and getting automation into it and trying to match it up. But mm-hmm. in that aspect, you had mentioned about human in the loop. So how much of human intervention are you looking at? Like it is the simple examples what you quoted. It may be an interpretation of the algorithm which will match, but it may not be correct. So how much of human in the loop is involved in this, and what level you know this helps us? That is the thing we should have to.
Okay. So Captain Srikant, right? Yes. So first of all, excellent question, and thank you for sort of providing a little bit of context of your question as well. So in the context of deep match, right, really what would happen is that you got let's say two tables and system would figure out matching. Now most likely what's going to happen is that large fraction of that matching is going to be right, but there will be small fraction of that will be wrong. Okay. Now the question is that how would machine know that? You can't expect human to go and check each one of them. Otherwise, human might as well do it. So the right way to look at this is a kind of a nice, simple, interactive and setting. Again, I'll be more than happy to sort of follow up to sort of show you more details. But one way to think about that is that machine will produce few examples for the human, and human can give thumbs up or down. And that would help machine further continue to sort of keep learning from it. And this would sort of effectively try to get close to 100% accuracy to the extent possible. And again, sort of really what's happening is that one human is providing few examples that are chosen by machine carefully. And that's how sort of its response is happening. So really it's very minimal human interaction, but it's a right type of human interaction in a sense, because the way I believe it is AI is never perfect. In AI, exception is a norm. Exception is not an exception. So we want to bring people to just account for those exceptions by providing just minimal feedback, and at the same time work with the machine. And that's what I meant by human in the loop. So again, a fantastic question. Thank you for asking that.
Good morning, sir.
One more question from the audience, sir.
Good morning, sir. Regarding deep cast, I have one particular question regarding the comparison which presently using Arima, which we generally use for a single layer. How your particular model which you are using is better than that, because in our military applications we have multi-layer data which needs to have certain prediction and forecasting.
Yes.
Second, let's assume I don't have any money and I want to build something from open source on similar lines of deep cast, specifically for military applications, without licensing, without using, without money. Which models you prefer and recommend us, sir, so that we can build our something of our own model? Thank you.
Great. So, first of all, thank you for your question. So, if I may understand correctly, let me parse your question in two parts, right? Part one is there is a prediction setting or time series setting that you are thinking about where, let's suppose, I'm just making it up. You want to predict what is the demand of shoes in Maharashtra, but you also want to predict demand of shoes in India. Okay. Now, of course, the demand of shoes in India is summation of the demand of shoes in all states. And so you want to figure out how do you predict at multiple such layers consistently simultaneously. So that's one question, if I understood correctly. And the second question is that Arima or not, what is a good open source platform that you can use? Okay, so maybe for the second part, again, with Ikigai, you can sort of, if you want to sort of use a large amount of scaling and data, you may want to pay, you will have to pay money. But again, so if you want to just use it as a self-serve, you can just go sign up and use it. So that's one thing you could do. If you really want to go and install your own versions of library behind the Deepcast, then you can go to the open source that's available on the website that I was sort of giving on my slides. And maybe later I can sort of share slides with the audience, if you're interested, it's tspdb.mit.edu, and that's where those models are available. And these models would naturally try to account for relationship between multiple time series of these multi-layer time. So you got, I think, two options. Either you sign up on self-serve on Kikai Labs website and you can get going, or you can just download the open source on your machine and then get going with that.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Before we come back to the audience at Lighthouse for the questions, I will take one online question, sir, from Captain Jagannath.
Good morning, Professor. Am I audible?
Yes, absolutely. Hello, Captain.
Thank you for such a great talk, and it's quite enlightening to see, you know, such applications coming in real time. These are dream come true kind of applications, I feel. Now, having said that, you know, you mentioned in your presentation, what I gathered is, you know, a lot of your application will work on structured data or maybe little unstructured. So our challenge here is most of our data is unstructured, I mean, in the forms of letters, scanned documents, etc. And if it can it match with the structured data and develop this, you know, forecasting or deep matching, etc. You have not addressed that part.
It's a fantastic question, Captain. So just to parse Captain's question, right, that let's suppose your data is not in a spreadsheet form, but in the form of a PDF file. And a PDF file has some structure, some form, but it's still a PDF. So for example, some of the functionalities in the platform are that it can sort of easily read data into PDF form and convert it into spreadsheet. If there's a some kind of, again, if it's PDF is just a, let's say a long text, let's suppose it's just a long poetry like Mahabharata, I'm not sure sort of machine will be able to do that, but assume that sort of it's a one some form with some fields and information like that, and you want to sort of extract that, then it will be definitely be able to do that. So that was one part. The second part, which I think more interesting that potentially you are raising, is what if it's a very noisy scanned information? Then I think this is where maybe you might want to sort of build some kind of an OCR-like plugins. Now, the way at least we build platform Ikigai is we've made it extensible. So you can, you have a data source you connect to where sort of, let's say, scanned letters are coming. In real time, as you build the pipeline, you can plug in some kind of a simple script or a code that would sort of on every piece of data source will apply, and then downstream it would provide a transformed output. So some of those feasibilities are there.
So my second part of the question, if I may ask, is there any kind of portable version of it so that we can transport it? Because all of our networks are private networks, and it is not permitted to take data out of this network and try it on your website.
Absolutely.
What is the layout? Is there any portable? You know, that is a challenge, but notwithstanding, we can do some, you know, vulnerability analysis and get the portable form of your application into our network. Is there any way out for this?
Absolutely. So I think sort of if for example, in your environment is, let's say you got a bare metal machines and let's say with Linux operating system, then this can be entirely installed in your environment, and then you can just run it in within your thing.
Thank you. Thank you.
So you mean to say that it is available as an on-premises solution?
That's correct. But again, sort of, it's not downloadable. You'll have to sort of work with us.
Okay. Do we have any more questions from the audience present here?
Good morning, Professor. I am Commodore J.S. Dhanova. So you come from obviously a good mathematical background, and mathematics is very deterministic. And you've sort of moved on to artificial intelligence, which isn't as deterministic as mathematics would be. So how do you, if I may use the word, compromise between the mathematical deterministic nature of your understanding of the subject and the large amount of variance and the acceptance of exceptions that AI now compels you to do?
It's a brilliant question, Commodore. So thank you for asking. Now, in a sense, it's a contradiction in the nature, so to speak, as you point out. So I think one of the saving grace here is the way I would like to think of all AI and data, instead of just thinking of them as a deterministic rules, as outcome of probabilistic models. So in a sense, I want to explicitly model the unknowns as unknowns and leave them sort of so to be with it, and then sort of work with determinism. That is, field of mathematics with probabilistic model allows me to sort of achieve exactly the right level of compromise that is required by a field of AI in the modern times. And so in that sense, when going back to that simple example and a question Captain earlier asked about human in the loop, really bringing exception and treating that exception as the uncertainty, modeling that way, bringing it to human so that human can resolve that uncertainty and then machine can learn a little better, is one way to sort of overcome this, let's call it, fundamental contradiction, which is in the nature of AI.
Thank you so much.
We have one question from Dr. Manjeet Shanawar from IIT Bombay.
Hello, Devraj. This is Manjeet.
We may be not able to see.
Oh, it's okay.
You come
here. My voice is audible. No? Hi, Devraj. I am Manjeet from Industrial Engineering and Operations Research Department at IIT Bombay.
Very nice to see you.
So I saw deep in all the three methods, but you also said that especially in the deep cast, maybe you have to work with limited data. So, but yes. Whenever we talk of deep, we really need large amount of data. Like, are you really using kind of deep neural networks or some basic ML algorithms here?
So actually, on all of these three things, all the academic work behind it is all published. Coming to the deep casting, you could call it, is just a play on the words, so to speak, where the highest level, the algorithms, as you might see behind the scene, are very much algebraic. Basically, we view the data or multiple time series at scale as some form of a tensor structure. And what we're really trying to do is impute the tensor and missing values using algebraic methods like tensor estimation and finding sort of the low rank tensor decomposition. So there's no neural network. There is no voodoo there. Everything is explicit.
Great. Okay. Thank you, Devraj.
Of course. Thanks for asking the question.
Do we have any more questions? Sir, we'll take one last question. Sir. That's for me. So when we talk about deep match, and you have given some examples also. So we have certain applications of the data stretching, data fusion. For example, the position of the ship coming from two, three different sources. And not only they are coming from two different sources in the same format, like lat long, but they are coming from two different kind of knowledge. Like one is coming from, say, radar, one is coming from sonar, and one is coming from GPS, it's coming from AIS. And they're different format. So what kind of approaches we should look at doing such kind of data fusion? And what kind of metrics or evaluation metrics should we have if we kind of developing, or not in-house, even giving it to the academia and industry to develop? What kind of evaluation metrics should we have to develop such kind of data fusion solution?
So it's a fantastic question. So I think, my view would be that with many of these data fusion problems, with limited number of, let's call it, golden examples, that is, first machines would try to sort of, in an unsupervised learning manner, try to sort of build relationship, but that is likely to be sort of very noisy. And this is where few golden examples given by a human in the loop interaction would sort of help improve the quality of them. And that would enable sort of better stitching. And then finally, to evaluate it at the end of the day, human evaluator is the best way to sort of do that. That is, collect good labeled data set, and then against it, try to evaluate by doing appropriate cross-validation.
I will take like one example to understand more. Is that suppose there is a doppelganger merchant ship who is transmitting AIS messages, and she the ship is transmitting some kind of number which is identified, which is called MSI number, and it is just, it's changing the number every 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and you know, moving ahead. And there are graph theoretic based approaches which do certain kind of data stitching. It's called AIS stitching. So we are able to still map that ship movement.
Yes.
So what kind of particular research is happening in this area, which can we can look into as center of excellence for AI research problems? What are the different new research is happening in this?
So it's funny that you asked this question, because 5 years ago, I was looking at this question because AIS is one of those largest publicly available data set, and then sort of you can actually tamper with your AIS ID, so to speak, all the time. So I think at some level for me, the deep match was actually for motivation came from some of those things.
Thank you, sir. We would like to collaborate further with you to see what we can have some kind of on-premises solution of deep match, as well as and try to maybe have an online cloud-based experience of it for some kind of problems.
Absolutely. Please feel free to reach out to me. I would love to help in the whichever way.